Yeah, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard? Not the billiards. It was... Come on, Rudy.
What?
Come on. We call it the...
The place to be.
The place to be. Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can...
Time to play the game!
Well, you always left me satisfied and smiling, so...
That's what she said!
Why do I want this?
Yeah.
Because I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, it is now time for the Place to Be podcast. And now your hosts, Justin Rosero and Scott Friscolo.
District, we in the red light district. We in the red light district.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, and joining me, as always, the man who wears brown belt and black shoes, straight out of the red light district of Norwalk, Connecticut, my PIC, Scott Crisolo. Scott, how you doing?
I told you, it was a reversible belt, and I forgot to turn it around.
How do you forget to turn it around, though? Did you have it on those pants already?
I always normally wear... brown belt with those green pants, and I forgot that I normally don't wear black shoes with those pants, but I wore it because it went with the black shirt, so I had the Brett thing going on, so I forgot to turn the buckle over to the black side of the belt, so yeah, that was it.
The fact that you're dressed like Andy Bernard aside, let's move on to our show tonight, and we're reversing order as we talked about this week, and we're going to start with our vintage vault, so I hope you brought the keys, because we do need
I did. Nope, they're right here. In fact, I already have the door open, so I just have to open the door and go in and take it out of the file of a new year.
Yes.
We have locked up 1988, and it is Happy New Year, the final year of the rock and wrestling decade known as the 1980s.
And of course, so every wrestling pay-per-view year starts with one of the greatest shows of the year, and that is the Royal Rumble.
Hulk Hogan! Matthews Brown! Axon Smash Demolition, Hakim the African Dream, the Red Rooster, and Jake the Snake Roberts, Luke and Butch the Bushwhackers, Greg the Hammer Valentine, Andre the Giant, Rick Martel, the Rockers, Big John Studd, and the Honky Tonk Man, Rugged Ronnie Garvin, and the Brain Busters, Tito Santana, and the Powers of Pain, the Big Boss Man, and Coco Beware, Hercules, Outlaw Ron Vance, Mr. Perfect, Brutus the Barber, the Million Dollar Man, the Macho Man, Randy Savage, all participating in the Royal Rumble.
And there you have it. Of course, the epic Vince McMahon introductions at all these early Rumbles featured. And I also like his little New England accent that randomly came out on Red Rooster.
I always wonder, though, doesn't he know how many guys are on the... He always goes, and this guy. Oh,
like
yeah, that guy,
just,
too.
I feel like he probably just records them all. And then they organize them. Somebody just says and a bunch of times, I'm not sure. But even the last guy they had, the Macho Man, he didn't say and, so.
Yeah, that's true.
It was very odd.
Yes. Of course, we are talking about, on our this edition of the Vintage Vault, it is the 1989 Royal Rumble. And the first Royal Rumble on pay-per-view, January 15th, 1989, from a place that was actually very busy in the 1980s for its basketball. That is the Summit in Houston, Texas, home of 2 years of NBA Finals games, as the Houston Rockets made it to the NBA Finals twice in the 1980s, 1981 and 1986, both times losing to Mr. Rosero's Boston Celtics. First time that pay-per-view has entered the state of Texas, and it would not be the last by any stretch of the imagination. I don't think they go to Houston again, though, for probably 5 or 6 years, I think, right?
98, is that the next time?
Is really that the next time that they go to in Houston? 9 years? Must be. They go to Dallas. They love going. They'll go to San Antonio often in the next 5 years.
I don't think they even go to Dallas for a long time.
No, I don't think they go to Dallas either. I don't have my indexed list of cities.
2000 maybe they go to Dallas.
Dallas, fully loaded 2000.
Yeah,
it must be.
So.
Yeah, I know they're in Houston. Obviously, as you mentioned, No Way Out of Texas, February 98 before WrestleMania 14. I don't think they're in Houston before that. They're in San Antonio a crap load of times. But yeah, this will be the first time they are in the third biggest market, actually, in the country, city of Houston. One notch was actually at the time, or fourth biggest, actually. And the crowd of 19,000 jacked for their first big pay-per-view. Buy rate. Now, here we go again. Here we go talking about buy rates again, and we're not going to go through the whole formula. But this buy rate, only 1.5. Now, is that because the pay-per-view crowd is larger? Or is it because maybe there was just a bit of a slump? Because 1.5, I mean, I know 1.5 is obviously the pay-per-view audience is bigger. We understand. I mean, we know that. You and I have talked about that. But that's a big dip. I believe the 88 Survivor Series was like 2.5. So 1.5 seems like a pretty big dip for a buy rate.
It's probably going to be a little bit of both, I'm guessing. Just the product cooling off and the change in, in the cable system. And also part of it may be, too, this kind of unknown pay-per-views type. You know, the Royal Rumble show that was given away for free the year before.
Mm.
So maybe that's part of it. I don't know.
That is true. And obviously, as time progresses, this would end up, and you and I talked about this when we did the 88 review, this will end up being a lot of people's favorite yearly pay-per-view, even sometimes more than WrestleMania.
Yes.
Buy rate again, 1.5. 19,000, though, which is probably a sellout for the summit. Our usuals in the booth, Gorilla Monsoon, Jesse the Body Ventura. We have two dark matches, and then one match that on the Coliseum video is not there, and we'll get to that one when it comes up on the match list. Dark matches, Jim Powers defeats Barry Horowitz. And you think to yourself, what would even possess them to even put this match up? Hmm. It's just an odd combination of two guys.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, you know, Jim Powers, I actually watched a couple episodes of Wrestling Challenge from late 88 today. And the Stallions were still kind of getting a push at that point. They had promos on a couple, two straight episodes, and they were kind of still getting pushed as a legit team. So I think Jim Powers wasn't really quite on the level we get to know him over the next couple years, like that Jobber the Star level. So I guess I kind of see it.
Yeah, well, he got the win anyway. And then the other, the second dark match, Sam Houston defeats Steve Lombardi.
I'm guessing this used Houston here for the Texas tie-in, I'm sure, because he wasn't around much longer.
No, it was probably just a cheesy pop to get the crowd going when the show started.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of intrigue, a lot of drama heading into this match. Last time we talked, the Mega Powers were solid, sort of. And a brand new feud just explodes on this show, and we'll get to that in a moment. The opener, I will begin. Match number one, a six-man tag. One that I'm always torn on. Probably overall, it's not that bad a match. I guess it's a matter of taste. Your heel team is the Rougeau brothers, Jacques and Raymond, and Dino Bravo. So obviously the full French-Canadian team here, Jimmy Hart, and I believe Frenchie Martin was at ringside, right?
He was still with Bravo. He's with them at least through five. I think we don't see Bravo without him until the end of the year.
Mm. And the babyface team is the former World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions, Bret the Hitman Hart, Jim the Anvil Neidhart, the Hart Foundation, and everybody's favorite. Yeah, that
we haven't heard it in a while.
Yeah, that guy. Yeah, Hacksaw, Jim Duggan. What's that?
Nothing. Go ahead.
Oh, that's enough. it is a 2 out of 3 falls match, and I just listened to the open of the show. I don't know if you caught this. According to Gorilla, this is intercontinental rules.
Yes, I do remember that. And that meant because it was in I think it had to do with the Canadian team, some just kind of heel chicanery they pulled. Really don't know what intercontinental rules meant, to be honest with you.
No, but, I think it's the only time it's ever actually been referred to in a six-man tag.
Yeah, I think so.
Atmosphere.
But
so.
I do remember them talking about that.
Yeah. Really no fun facts here, just a six-man to get the show started, nothing, no real backstory. I've always been
Well, a little bit, actually. Not angle-wise, but, I mean, you know, Rougeau was in the heart, still had the bad blood.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Bravo and Duggan were feuding around this time. They had a lot of build on those. I'll probably reference those challenge episodes a lot because they're actually the first two after Survivor Series I watched today because that's what's up this month on Classics On Demand, .com rather. And they were really pushing a Duggan Bravo feud through promo. So I'm guessing that was working the house show circuit at this point. Weird thing is they don't fight until the next show's WrestleMania. You'd think they would have fought at, you know, 5 the way they were building it. So it's kind of weird.
That was kind of strange. This match I'm always torn in this match. It annoys me, and then at the same time, it actually entertains me. As everyone knows, it's no secret as we keep playing the theme, I'm not the biggest Jim Duggan fan on Earth. I am a big Hart Foundation fan, and I do like the Rougeaus. Now, I would be more than happy to just make this a tag match and be done with it. And having said that, they make this 6-man tag. The match total is about just under 15 minutes. Ray Rougeau pins Brett about 4.5 minutes in. Then Duggan pins Raymond at 10:10. And then finally Brett pins Dino at 14:55. But what does he pin him with? And this is the continuing argument that I continuously say pissed me off as a kid in these late 80s and early 90s with Hacksaw Jim Duggan. He takes the 2x4, whacks Dino Bravo in the back of the head with it, and Brett gets the pin. All this time, all these challenges and prime times and superstars and Gorilla thumping the virtue of, you know, good fan favorites and no cheating and no foreign objects and no, you know, chicanery or tomfoolery to take matches. But when he pulls out the 2x4, yippee-ki-yay, yay, Jim Duggan saves the day. I don't get it. Made no sense. Made no sense whatsoever. Why Jim Duggan got the creative license to cheat and Gorilla said that was okay and everybody else...
I think he clearly explains it here, I'd say.
I got my 2x4 over my other shoulder. I start going through the screen. The people start saying, USA! USA! And I'm like, my neck stands straight up. The blood starts pumping through my heart.
Now, how can you argue with that logic right there? He has the two by four. He hears the crowd start chanting USA. The hair stands up on his neck. His blood starts pumping, and he goes out there and says, "Oh, that's obviously the explanation behind the usage of the 2x4."
That's tremendous. I wish it was blood pumping out his forehead if someone hit him with the 2x4. That's what I say.
I don't know what more of an explanation you need than that song right there. He runs through the whole gamut of emotions.
If you're gonna use that as your explanation, then you might need to bring your man Andrew.
It sounds like that song is written directly to as a retort to you back in 1993. It's like almost like Duggan knew this was coming, so he went back in time and created this song with Simon Cowell and had this hit record just so God. We could have this podcast here today and I could explain it to you why he likes God. To use the 2x4.
Well. I know you're in this Nostradamus mood, but you're really reaching for straws here. So, come on now. In any event, the action itself is not bad.
Actually, you should be digging it because maybe you view Duggan as the third Antichrist.
Maybe. That's true. Maybe he should have been shot in the Afghanistan mansion, too. I don't know. Anyway, the action itself is fine. Again, you're dealing with two exceptional tag teams. Great work rate. Duggan and Bravo kind of go along. They're two big, burly guys. So, you know, they bring what they can. Overall, it's not a bad match. Crowd's hot. At least the result fires the crowd up, being the opening match. So the match itself, I have no problem with. It's well done. A lot of good action. It's like a 2.5.
I like it. And it sets a template of Rumbles to follow, actually, where they would have kind of that opening tag match with the face team going over to get the crowd pumped up. I like it. I have no complaints.
No, I just think that ending just always annoys me because Gorilla just thumps it match after match throughout his career about tomfoolery and chicanery. But then when Duggan uses his 2x4, everything's all fine. So it just drove me crazy. But the match itself, I have no problems with. It was very good. So it's a good opener, two good tag teams. I don't know. Or Bretton, I gotta check. Is Brett or do they do double duty? I know the Rougeaus, I think, do double duty.
No, one did.
Neither of them did. Okay, that's weird. That's it for their night, which usually doesn't happen as we go to further rumbles throughout the 90s. Plenty of tags do double duty and plenty of guys do double duty. Not this night, though. The Harts and Rougeaus are finished. They get to go back and drink some beer.
And with the ending of this Duggan match, I will read three. I'm going to do this from now on when we talk about Duggan matches. Three of Hacksaw J. Duggan's tweets. Of course, that is the fake Jim Duggan, who you should all be following. So here is three of his more recent ones from today. Repo Man tried to steal my morning newspaper, which is weird because he can't read. Now he can't walk either, thanks to my 2x4, USA. There's another one.
God.
Mr. Fuji was super ticklish. He also had a horizontal butt crack, which was way weirder. He pooped laying down, USA, USA. And finally, before he died, Rick Rude donated his mustache to science. Now we all know the true impact of mustache injuries, USA. USA.
Oh, was he tweeting these in the car with on the Jersey Turnpike with the Iron Sheik?
And he's also he also live tweets Raw here off and on, so it's pretty good stuff. So there's your Hacksaw J. Duggan fix.
All right, if as long as you do that, I can tolerate all this Duggan nonsense. All this Duggan nonsense for the next four and a half years till 1993 King of the Ring.
Sure.
Anyway, there's your opener. So the baby faces go over the Heart Foundation and HJD. And the crowd is jacked up at the summit. So there's your opener.
Yep, good stuff. Tag division still burgeoning.
Yes.
All right, coming off of that, now we have a establishment of one of the hottest feuds that would carry us through 1989.
Yes.
And that is involving Rick Rude and the current Intercontinental Champion, the Ultimate Warrior, coming off his feud with his house show feud with Andre the Giant a little bit. You know, still Honky Tonk Man. He's just kind of been bouncing around. I'm sorry, not Andre. That'd be the next year. I guess he was still feuding with Honky, right, at this point, heading into the show?
Warrior? Yeah, pretty much. I'm assuming they were filling out house show matches throughout the end of 88.
Yeah.
And then Warrior, this was just the kind of the retcon. Not retcon, but just kind of starting over for him and giving him something fresh. Yeah.
So they go ahead and set up a super pose down competition. Both guys obviously have ridiculously great physiques. Mm-hmm. And they were going to be deciding the winner by fan reaction. Four categories: the double biceps, the best abs, most muscular, and a medley of poses. Mm-hmm. And of course, the highlight here is Jesse Ventura just gushing over Rick Rude and the posing and ripping on Warrior's form and everything. He was just tremendous here, I thought.
Yes. I like when he mentions to Gorilla Sam Lopresti and the other guy from like 1929 doing bodybuilding. Those were the guys Gorilla remembers. I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah,
As usual, the banter is tremendous between these two.
Without a doubt. And Jesse was just the legitimacy he built upon this was tremendous.
Yes.
Of course, Warrior wins all the fan votes, which sets Jesse off. And, you know, pisses off Rude. So Rude grabs the bullworker, drills Warrior in the back of the head, then chokes him out with it in a great scene. Just seeing, like, Warrior's hair flying all over the place as Rude just, like, really wrenched back on that across Warrior's neck was great.
Yes.
So then Warrior gets up, and the agents and refs are trying to, you know, take care of him, and he beats the crap out of them all and runs off. So this feud is just getting going, but I thought it was a really, really great start for it.
Yeah, the Ultimate Warrior just needed something fresh, and this was obviously the perfect guy to feud with. Rude was ready to explode. Great character. These two guys stepped to the forefront of the mid-card division. And, you know, back then it was easy to write up a nice non-wrestling skit to set them up. Crowd was stoked about it, and it would lead end up becoming it's hard to distinguish, and maybe we'll have to bring that up as we continue on through our reviews here on the Place to Be podcast in our Vintage Vault specials. We will be doing our end of when we do the last pay-per-view of the calendar year, we'll start doing our year in review votes. We'll have to talk about whether we'll do that at the last pay-per-view or whether we do a separate podcast for that. We'll talk about that.
Maybe we'll just do it at the end because I don't think it would be enough on its own.
Yeah, no, it wouldn't take up a whole podcast. But anyway, when we talk about the end of 89, this conceivably could go down as the feud of the year in 1989. But we'll obviously there's plenty of candidates and we'll get to that when we get there. But this is a great start. Crowd is just pissed off. And I love Gorilla getting all, you know, mad with him. Why does he got to keep working out? Why does he keep oiling himself? Why does he keep doing this? It's just awesome. And Jesse's like, you have to be prepared, Gorilla. It's got to be mental. He has no abs. Warrior has no abs. I mean, it's like he's got one long ab muscle. It's like so funny. Just great, great back and forth banter. Crowd is just on their feet. And then Rude just flips out and just and it's funny. It always seems like when you're watching that certain camera angle, it always seems like something flies off the bulwarker because Rude whacks him pretty hard in the back of the head. And then, like you said, Warrior's mannerisms. You know, as much as this guy gets a lot of crap for being an absolute head case, he did get it when he needed to get it, and I think he deserves a lot of credit for that. And he really put this beating over.
Yes.
He really looked like he was gagging. And like his hair was getting caught under the bullworker. The rest of his hair was flopping around, like you mentioned, on top of his head. It was just tremendous vision, a visual, and a great way to set that feud up. And obviously, our next vault will let you know how it really gets going. But it was a great segment. good. It was pretty long. It was almost half an hour, maybe a little less, maybe like 25 minutes.
Yeah, it took a lot of time. But it was well. I mean, it was just as good as any match if I would have thrown it together here.
Exactly. And again, it was a great opportunity for both Rude and Warrior to establish themselves. Crowd was hot. Great commentary. Overall, a well packaged segment. So the crowd's hot. We move on to our next match, which pretty much Debbie Downers this entire show. And this is where we get into our frustrations over what the hell they did in the editing room when they released this tape. Just as a little background, the copy that I have in my library and the copy that Justin and I both used for our original written review, which you can see on our Place to Be message board, bigelow34.proboards.com. And while you're listening to this, open it up and follow along with it. You'll notice that there's matches are out of order. You'll notice there'll be a match missing, and Justin will get to that match next. But this match actually gets clipped. Thank God. It is a women's title match. The WWF Women's Championship, which a lot of people had forgotten about, and really. The champion is Rockin' Robin. Robin Smith is her name, and she is actually the sister, or half-sister? Sister. Stepsister?
Half-sister of Jake, but I think we went into this. She was at Survivor Series 87.
Okay, so she's, yeah, so she is the half-sister of Jake the Snake Roberts. She is Aurelian Smith, Grizzly Smith's daughter from one of the marriages. I think he was married twice. She is the current World Wrestling Federation Women's Champion. She defeated, I guess,
Sherry
at some point in 1988. Because we didn't see the title after Survivor Series 87. So,
right.
And her opponent is, and I can't believe this woman is still on the payroll.
Thank you for being a friend. Travel down the road back again.
Now, the sad thing is if you watch the women's match at Survivor Series 87, they actually don't look as haggard as they could have. But Judy Martin, who is Rockin' Robin's opponent in this match for the women's championship, clearly has seen better days. She obviously was already playing bingo at some retirement.
ECW arena.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say Boca Raton, but she could have been outside Philly in the meatpacking district. But here she is, brought out of the mothballs to be the number one contender to Rockin' Robin's championship. And no, folks, for you younger fans, if you're reading our review on the website, her real name is not Bea Arthur. Just wanted to make that clear. Now, it says here the match is 2:47 and it's clipped. The actual length of this match, and I believe it is in one of our descriptions. Maybe it's not. No, it's not. The actual description of this match, length of this match, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 17 minutes.
Yeah, 16:24.
Yeah. 6 minute and 24 second women's match in the late 1980s.
Yeah, we have to make it clear, obviously. We went back. The next match we're going to get to, we finally went back and watched that one because that was not part of the tape. We have, but we did not subject ourselves to 17 minutes of this match. We love all of our listeners, and we think you love us enough not to want us to put ourselves through that.
No.
And the worst part is that Sherry's on commentary, and for the 2 minutes she was on was atrocious enough, so I can only imagine what 17 minutes was like.
Yeah, and that's really amazing because Sherry is one of the greatest personalities of all time. She was an excellent promo cutter throughout her career. Great manager. We'll document it right here on the Place to Be podcast, as you'll see on our reviews as well. She's a Hall of Famer. God rest her soul. But I don't know what she was smoking this night, but she was abysmal with Gorilla and Jesse. I don't think she knew what the hell to talk about.
And Robin had she won the title on October 7th in Paris.
Okay,
and that's actually I think that's on that primetime Paris special that aired in October
of 88.
It's like a three-hour show.
Yeah, so this isn't – it's actually a legitimate match. This isn't like the Glamour Girls winning some Egyptian tournament or Pat winning the IC title in Rio. It was actually a real match that the title changed hands.
Right, and we should probably talk about the future of the title as well.
Yeah.
In any case,
as Justin said, we do love you all as fans. And if we – and I know a lot of you do have the Royal Rumble DVD anthology that came out. I was actually talking to our good friend Matt Rotella today about it. He'd watched it, but he puts himself through lots of torture. We don't want you to have to watch it. So I hope you respect us to know that we weren't going to watch it either. We wouldn't put you through that, so we're not going to go through it either. It's just it's probably a big piece of junk.
Yeah, and it's not even a historical match, the fact that Robin, no. It's just a standard defense, and I can't believe they couldn't find another match to put on this card outside of seven. I know Robin is from Texas, so maybe they thought they could capitalize a little bit, but I don't know. If anything, they should have done a mixed tag for a novelty and had Robin and Sam Houston against Sherry and someone, you know, whatever, Brawler or something. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Either
Ron
way, this
Bass
is
or something. I don't know.
Either way, this is atrocious. So Robin retains here. Sherry lays down the challenge. Now, we'll talk about this here because I don't think we're going to have time for it at five, but it seemed like they were actually building towards a match for them at five. In February of 89, they actually did a primetime special called WrestleMania Face to Face. I just watched this a couple months ago. And throughout the show, they had Vince hosting face-to-face interviews between all the WrestleMania competitors. So, like, Hogan and Savage went face-to-face, DiBiase and Beefcake, the Powers of Pain and Demolition, you know, everyone who would fight at WrestleMania. And this was actually one of the face-to-face confrontations, was between Sherry and Robin. So, you know, I don't know if they were just talking in general or if they were planning on having that match. Either way, it didn't make the card. Robin would hold the title throughout the summer of 89 and into 1990, actually, is when she finally left. But I don't know if it was even ever, you know, televised or anything like that again after this for the most part. And then the title remains inactive until 93.
Right, exactly. I mean, at this point, the division is just a joke. Vince had and the Bookers had much more important things to do. The burgeoning tag division, the tag division, which was exploding. And we obviously have some awesome, solid mid-card feuds. So the women's division, which by the Rock and Wrestling era, after Wendy Richter and Spider Lady and Moolah and all that, really became nothing more than filler. And when once Vince really pumped up the mid card, the women's division was really unnecessary.
Even when it was basically Moolah's vanity title, you know.
Yeah, it really was. It's been that. I mean, probably the women's title probably lost a lot of its teeth by 1986. It's funny because the women's. That the biggest feud next to the title match, next to the main event at the first WrestleMania, really the feud that rejuvenated, that really fired up that first WrestleMania was indeed Leilani Kai and Moolah against Wendy Richter and Cyndi Lauper. After that, once Vince started to really pick guys from the other federations and really started to build the mid-card, he didn't need the women's division anymore.
No.
So it just got cast off.
And now Robin's last house show was June 25th, and her and Judy Martin pretty much just went around the circuit throughout that whole spring and summer. They pretty much just fought each other on various house shows.
Ugh.
That's
the time you go to the concession line or go take a leak. One or the other.
Yeah, I can't even. I'm trying to find when her last. And of course, I'm looking on the tremendous Graham Cawthon's history of WWE.com. Looks like she was on a couple televised house shows. Here's the face to face they did on that primetime. And I don't think she was even on television again, honestly, outside of her singing the national anthem at WrestleMania 5. It looks like outside of a couple of televised house shows, she was never on actual TV defending the title. It was all pretty much house show televised matches and house shows in general.
Yeah, so the women's division really starts to lose its importance because, again, as I've said, as we both said, Vince really boosted the mid-card at this point. He had awesome personalities, great feuds. He didn't need the women's title anymore. He wouldn't really pump it up again until he got the crown jewel of the women's division in WCW 4 years later, one of Justin's favorites. And we'll get to her when we get there. So there you have it. Now, here's the – Justin will introduce the next match, and this is where the whole –
You're going to play it one more time in memorial of Judy Martin.
Yes.
And actually, her Golden Girl teammate will return unexpectedly in a few years down the road as well.
Yes, she will. So, God bless you. What's her name? I lost it in my head. The B. Arthur's mom there. What her name is?
Sophia.
Sophia. Yeah, I couldn't think of the actress. Oh, it's in my head. I can't think of it. Oh well. Estelle Getty. Thank you. God rest her soul. Actually, it's kind of sad. The only Golden Girl left is Betty White. So. Which means the only Golden Girl left is Donna Christianella.
And somehow you've outlived them all, amazingly enough.
Well, of course, yes. I mean, I was, yeah, exactly. I remember Judy Martin when she was bouncing on Gorgeous George's knee. But anyway, now we'll get into the editing part. Justin will introduce our next match, speaking of old guys, old guy. And this is where the editing problem comes in. Go ahead.
Yeah,
match. And now you'll wonder why we get frustrated. Go ahead.
This match was edited off the Coliseum video. It was on the Royal Rumble Anthology when they re-released all the shows. I had never actually seen it until this past week. I finally sat down and watched it. And I actually liked the match quite a bit. And I am surprised that they took it off the Coliseum video release. I mean, I can't say they should have left the women's match off in you know, exchange for this, because they only showed 2 minutes of the women's match. So it's not like they had enough time to show this, because this match went 9 minutes. So anyway, the match here is to determine the official king, and that is King Haku against the newly turned face Harley Race. And I guess technically he wasn't quite fully a face here, because Bobby's actually kind of playing it down the middle, and like when Harley was on offense, he'd cheer for Harley and root him on. When Haku was on offense, he would root him on. So it was clear that he was just going to go with the winner, and Gorilla was very astute in commentary, beating that point home throughout the match. But I love the way the match got started. Haku got carried out by all the minions, and Harley came over and tipped the throne over, and Haku went flying into the ground. So I thought that was a cool open. And this is a pretty stiff match. They really laid into each other, and the pace was fine for two guys like this. You know, Haku, he could go, but and you know, maybe it wasn't that surprising. Harley could still kind of go here. And watching this match, I actually thought Harley could have had a decent run through 89 and 90 as a face. Because he would reprise that role in 1990 and 1991 in WCW when he returned there. So I thought he could have done a good job in that role, watching him here sell and kind of gain sympathy. The highlight spot of the match was when Harley pile drove Haku on the floor. Even though it was the mat and he didn't get him full, it was still a pretty good spot for 1989, I thought. And then Haku eventually would hit a nice thrust kick as Harley was running at him. Kicked him square in the face and pinned him to retain his crown. And that would pretty much be it for Harley. I don't think he'd last too much longer here.
No, I don't remember him being on TV again. I know that by 1990...
Yeah, that's it. Well, actually, he's at a house... No, that's it. That's his last show.
Yeah, I know he takes some time off, and I know he was still kind of running his promotion in Kansas City, sort of. I know at some point, whenever Vader debuts in WCW, which is sometime in mid to late 90, he's not managed by Harley yet. I think he's managed by Harley by early 91. So I think Harley takes like a year off, goes back to his area of the country, the Midwest, Kansas City area. He had a promotion going there, one of the NWA like central states.
He actually went down to Puerto Rico as well.
Yes, he did. He did actually go down to Puerto Rico. So, but as for the match, I just watched it. Honestly, I'm not even joking, folks. I just watched the match for the first time ever about an hour ago. And just to get ready, I tried to watch
actually,
it.
Actually, just to clarify on Harley, he left. He went to Puerto Rico, and he actually went to AWA as well. He challenged Larry Zbyszko in the final AWA TV taping in August 1990. He challenged Zbyszko for the title. And then he went to WCW. Actually, I'm sorry. He was in WCW before that AWA match, and that he fought at the Bash, Great American Bash. He fought Tommy Rich. He received some U.S. title shots against Lex Luger. Then he went to AWA, and then he retired. And he showed up in July '91 as Lex Luger's manager when he turned heel, and then he joined up with Vader.
That's right. That's right. He did go. He does go with Luger. That's right. Because I remember for a good 2 years, at least during the stretch when Ric Flair was a face, they would pump up the whole big thing and the Starrcade '83 match and all that kind of stuff. They drove that into the ground when Harley would be managing any heels. The match itself is really not, again, folks, I just watched an hour ago for the first time. I tried to watch it today. I was a little busy at work. I watched it a little while ago during our pre-production. And it is a good match. It's stiff. It's nothing fancy. But for God's sakes, you and I were talking about it while we were prepping. Maybe it's money. Anytime I can't think of a logical reason for something creatively, it has to be money. Why, for the love of God, was the actual tape not long enough? Was it maybe because they were taping it on SP that they couldn't fit the match
on
there?
I don't know. I mean, these tapes are weird. I mean, you know, we talked about it. WCW/NWA did this a lot at that time. And even WWF through about 1990, I think by 91, they stopped editing stuff. But it must have to do with the cost of the tape. And maybe if they went over 2 hours or 3 hours, it was, maybe it just was much too expensive at that point. So I'm not sure, but there had to be, obviously, like you said, some financial reason behind it. I don't see why they would just randomly cut these matches out.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand, obviously, if you're going to use one of the two matches, I still don't understand for the life of me why they picked 2 minutes of Rock and Robin. Even if you cut this match a little bit, down to maybe 5 minutes if you had to, I'm fine with that at least.
Yeah.
But why, for the love of God, do you not put this, which at least had some type of intrigue in the storyline, instead of sticking 2 minutes of that crap on there. I just don't understand. I don't get it. It had to have been – maybe they were underestimating the amount of space on an SP tape, I guess. I don't know. I can't – I mean, I have the tape on my shelf. It's kind of hard to see what whether or not it was – what the length of the tape. It's about a two-hour show. I mean, I don't know how long the tape itself is. I can't fathom it.
Well, maybe, too, they just didn't want to spend – waste. Well, I can't even say that because the women's division was dead anyway. I was going to say maybe they didn't want to waste time on – you know, Harley Race was gone, but you think they'd want to put Haku over, you know?
Yeah, and it did. It might be one of the few legitimate singles wins for Haku. I would have put it on the tape. I think it would have been great for him. He was an enduring character, a guy Vince trusted. You figure they'd let him put a win on a tape. I don't know. It's one of the mysteries, the great mysteries of the old school Titan Sports Coliseum video editing floor. I don't know.
Maybe we can get Hillbilly Jim on our podcast and we can ask him all the secrets of Coliseum video.
Yes. You know, don't you have a cell phone number? He was going to get back to you about when 24/7 was going to come.
Yeah, he still hasn't gotten back to us. I'm still waiting.
I know. That was 6 years ago. So we'll tell you that story another day, but us meeting Hillbilly Jim. But I don't know. It just the match itself is good. I have no problem with it. I like the power driver. It's two stiff guys, two guys that could smack each other hard and just keep rolling. I mean, that's the intrigue about a match like that is you've got two guys who – really could take a they are like $2 steaks. I mean, they could smack the crap out of each other and not even blink, and that's what makes a match like that so intriguing. So it's unfortunate. I wish everyone was able to, but just, you know, go onto YouTube or go to Daily Motion, you know, type Haku versus Harley Race 1989 Royal Rumble, and it's right there. There's plenty of clips of it. Mm-hmm. Or you, if you have the DVD anthology, you're very lucky. Because you get to watch that, and then, of course, you'll have to skip the problem with that is you have to watch the 17-minute women's match before it, unless you just go to the next clip. But, yeah, I just don't get it. It's really not a bad match. The whole intrigue with Bobby, the double managing, and Gorilla, and Jesse sits there all coy in the throne that's sitting there on the side. I mean, it's, the whole package was really good. It's unfortunate that they didn't put it on. I just don't understand. It had to have been some type of either financial or technical reason that we don't know about. And yeah, so be it, you know. So if you have the Coliseum video like I do and like Justin does, at least for time's sake you have it. But really, you know, go out and get the DVD anthology. I'm sure it's cheap now on Amazon. It's been a couple of years. It's worth getting. We have to get it ourselves, kind of shorten our tape space here. But, yeah, so it's a good match. Catch it on YouTube or Daily Motion, or if you have the DVD anthology, you're pretty lucky. So, yeah,
so. All right, match. Let's move on to the Rumble now.
Yes.
Which is the main event of the show. And, of course, at this point, we still have nothing in the line for this. No title shot or any kind of prize yet. So the world champion is in the match, Macho Man Randy Savage.
Right.
As we'll see in a minute. So, Scott, we will set things up here then, obviously. And at this point now, we have 30 competitors, not 20 like the year before. And 2 minutes in between each entrant.
Exactly. And I will and Justin and I will go by fives. We'll let you know who gets in the match to start. There is one debut, and I'll bring it up because he comes up fifth in the match.
Actually, when you get to him, we'll name him.
We'll get to him. We'll talk about
it. There's actually a couple debuts.
Okay. The first guy that enters the ring is a Demolition Axe, one half of the current World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions, Demolition Axe. And ironically, who comes in number two? Demolition Smash. Now, interesting thing about this is, obviously, it's a pretty cute little hook to get the match going. And, you know, Demolition Axe, Demolition Smash, both, you know, obviously loyal tag team champions to each other. But you know what? What the hell? They'll beat the hell out of each other if they want. What do they care?
Yeah, so, this was clearly done to set the tone, you know, on the first pay-per-view Rumble to set the whole thing about every man for himself. You know, no partners, no teammates or anything like that. That these guys are fighting to win this thing, and right off the bat, it's just showing that anything can happen in this type of match.
Right, and I think Demolition was the perfect choice for it because they have that reputation of just being brawlers, and you know what, we're so tough and mean, we'll beat on each other.
Yeah,
and it doesn't take away from like Bret and Anvil doing it; it wouldn't have worked.
Right,
or any of those other kind of teams, Shawn and Marty wouldn't have worked. It worked here because you know they're just tough bastards. And they're tag champions. They're still baby faces. And they're like, what the hell? Let's beat the hell out of each other. It's like a workout. It's like a scrimmage. And that's exactly how they laid it out. So it worked out perfectly. That was actually a good creative choice to have. If you're going to do something like that, this is the tag team you do it with.
And it worked out well, too, the way as soon as the next guy comes in, who you'll talk about in a second, you know, they stop fighting each other and immediately start fighting him.
Exactly. And they need to. The third guy that comes in is Andre the Giant, all 515 pounds of him, as they say. Obviously, Axe and Smash decide, well, now it's time to be tag team champions again, and they work to try to get him out. Mm-hmm. Number four, a up-and-coming awesome mid-card heel, and we've talked about him extensively, and that is Kurt Hennig, Mr. Perfect. Don't think he's got the neon tights yet. I think he's still wearing regular blue tights. I don't think he debuts neon until WrestleMania.
No, yeah, he doesn't have the singlet. He still just has the short tights.
The short blue tights. I don't think he has the singlet. I don't think he has a singlet until WrestleMania. And then number five is our first debut. And another one of my... Do you have any video clips, audio clips? Because you usually like to torture
me. No, we'll save the good one. We'll save the good one for his crowning moment at SummerSlam.
Oh, God, I can't wait. The debut is... his real name is Roger Barnes. But you all know him more of his stage name, Rugged Ronnie Garvin, makes his debut here. Ronnie Garvin always cracked me up. He's originally from Montreal. They always say he's from Charlotte, but you can clearly tell when the guy talks he has a French-Canadian accent, so you figure it out. He is a former NWA world champion, which is slightly embarrassing. He's bounced around most of the southern promotions. He actually had a very good feud with Jake Roberts in Georgia over the Georgia television title. Jake talks about that extensively on his DVD. Then he moved on to Jim Crockett in Mid-Atlantic and would bounce and would pretty much be a pretty solid babyface.
Yeah, you know, I liked him. You know, he got forced into that feud with Flair to be world champion due to all some backstage politics with Dusty and Flair. But I thought the run he had before that, like in 85 and 86, was pretty good. I thought he was serviceable in that role.
Yeah, he was a national heavyweight champion. He lost the title and a loser leave town match to Black Bart in early 85. And then he ended up coming back. Mm-hmm. And then he actually cross dressed. He was part of the whole feud with, and you'll see it on our Starrcade 85 review on our message board. He actually dresses as Miss Atlanta Lively, mm-hmm. With, another one of my favorites, Jimmy Valiant. They all hang in packs, Jimmy, against Paul Jones' army. So he bounced around the Carolinas and Georgia for most of his career, until he signed in late 88 here. The title reign that Justin's referring to, in 1987, Ric Flair was feuding with Gorgeous Jimmy Garvin, and I think it was Gorgeous Jimmy Garvin. Yeah, and he would end up having a match, and something happened, and Garvin was a babyface, and he got screwed, and Ronnie Garvin came in, and they would end up having a match, and Ronnie Garvin actually won the NWA World Championship. Well, for some weird reason, Jim Crockett chose to keep Garvin off TV. And people want to see the champion.
Well, I think it's because I just don't think they had any faith in him as champion. He, like, got it because of a power struggle between Flair and Dusty arguing over who should be champion.
Exactly. And by Starrcade 87, the crowd is firmly in Flair's corner, and he easily wins it back in a cage match at Starrcade 87. So by then, he got kind of burnt out, and he kind of floated around a bit. And he came back at he came to the WWF in late 88, but this is his first major television pay-per-view appearance as mm-hmm. number five on the at the Royal Rumble. So, and he's around for a couple years, but as Justin says, the highlight of his WWF career comes up in August at the Meadowlands, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, and Andre, of course, made his mark quickly. He eliminated Garvin and Smash, first two guys he tosses. So
right,
pretty quick. For them.
Right.
So number six in, it was Greg Valentine, still kind of floating aimlessly. He's part of Jimmy Hart's stable, issuing random challenges here and there, just kind of fighting week to week. Number seven was the man Andre was in the middle of a very bitter feud with, and that's Jake Roberts. Of course, Andre is deathly afraid of snakes, and Jake's only in there for about 2 minutes before Andre tosses him. But then once that happens, Jake comes back with the snake, throws Damien in the ring. Andre freaks out and eliminates himself by hopping over the top rope and running to the back, deathly afraid of the snake. So in that meantime, Axe was also tossed. Number eight, he was tossed by Mr. Perfect. So number eight was Ron Bass. This is his final show. I think we kind of talked about him already.
Yeah. Yep.
But he just kind of floats around as well throughout the indies, right? I don't think he does much after leaving WWF. Yeah, he competed independence before retiring in 91, so that was it for him. So Bass, and then number 9 is one of the Rockers, Shawn Michaels. And number 10 is one half of another debuting team, and that is the former Sheepherders in the NWA, and that is now called, known as the Bushwhackers, Luke and Butch. In the NWA, they were vicious, vicious heels, of course, known as the Sheepherders, along with Johnny Ace, the flag bearer. Upon jumping here, they picked up this goofy theme music and revamped their whole style as kind of almost like Jim Duggan-esque, I guess, fan favorites. They played up the whole thing that they're from New Zealand. They don't really understand the American culture, kind of like a play on maybe what Outback Jack was kind of meant to be, I guess. Just kind of goofy, lovable guys from Down Under. So they debut in late 88, and then they show up here as well. So that is the next five there. And Butch hangs around actually for a while in this match. He's in for about 18 minutes.
As most of our close friends know, and eventually as you get to know us continuously here on the Place to Be podcast, I am not a big fan of the Bushwhackers, and it's kind of appropriate that Justin uses Duggan as an adjective. However, I will say this. Unlike Jim Duggan, who everyone tells me was an awesome character in Mid-South, and you should give him more respect and everything. Look, I haven't watched 1 minute of Mid-South wrestling. Not one. It's buried in Jim Watts' ex-wife's attic or whatever the hell it is. I don't know. But unlike here, I did watch a lot of Sheepherders when I was a kid. They were on NWA. I caught some tapes. There were a couple of PWI comps that I used to see at the video store. So I saw a lot of Sheepherder matches, and they were awesome. They had their New Zealand flag wrapped in barbed wire, and they were nasty, and I actually used them when Justin and I were in our territory wars on our board. I had them as my nasty heel team. I had no problem with Luke and Butch as the Sheepherders. I just never liked the whole Bushwhacker thing. Face-licking derelicts. Just never liked it. I thought he could have just used them as, maybe not as nasty. I know it's the cartoony late 80s. I understand that. You don't want to make them too nasty and freak kids out, but I would have been happy if they were a little gruff. But they were the poster child children for the type of characters that Vince wanted in the late 80s in WWF. So as much as I don't, they're low on my list of guys I hate. I definitely hate Duggan and Ronnie Garvin much higher than I hate the Bushwhackers. That character change just annoyed me because they were such good heels in the Midwest as the Sheepherders, and I just wish they had stayed that way.
It's too bad too that by the time the Attitude Era came, that they were so old and that they had, also kind of gained almost typecast with the Bushwhacker role, because they've actually been pretty cool heels in the Attitude Era with Violence, and I don't think they ever really had an ECW run, did they? Because they could have been good there too.
I don't think so. You know them though. You know ECW though. Most guys, some guys drove through the highway at some point between 94 and 99, so they might have stopped for a cup of coffee, maybe. I doubt it.
Yeah, it looks like they pretty much worked the indies and a lot of time in Puerto Rico, because they were in WWE after 96, so I wasn't sure if they popped in ECW, but they could have been cool as a kind of a Sheepherder rebirth.
Right. So I don't hate them as much as the other people on my most hated list. I just was upset that they had such awesome characters and Vince neutered them. But, like I said, it is the cartoony late 80s, so I can understand it. It just upsets me that they had such a great heel gimmick in the in the NWA, in the Midwest, and I think they were West Coast a little bit too. So that's the first 10. Number 11 is your former tag team your former Intercontinental Champion, and that is, of course, the Honky Tonk Man, who is continuing to, pay the dues, pay the piper.
Yeah, he only lasts 4 minutes here. So.
Yeah, so at number 12 is Tito Santana. Tito, of course, kind of floating through, and one half of Strike Force, although he's been solo for most of 88 and early 89 because of the injury to Ricky Martel. Ricky came back. We'll get to him in a little bit. He comes back soon, so Strike Force does reunite, but right now he's just kind of floating around.
And Tito actually had his theme song by this point on that challenge I watched. He had it. So I didn't realize he had it as early as 88.
I didn't either. But yeah, so he does, it's that kind of, Mexican.
Yeah, the well-known theme.
Yeah. At number 13 is a guy who this match is perfectly suited for, and that is, of course, Bad News Brown, who hated the Survivor Series concept because he hates teaming with anybody. And this is perfect for him, every man for himself. So he was perfect in this role. And then number 14 is one half of the Rockers, and that is Marty Jannetty, as they're continuing to feud with the Brainbusters. And then at number 15 is your first big, big guy in the match, and that is, of course, your World Wrestling Federation champion, the Macho Man, Randy Savage, gets in the match. So there's a lot of guys. I don't think there's been that many eliminations as of yet. Let's see. Let me put my entrant. Here we go. Let me put the draw first. Let's see. Honky lasts a little while. Butch and Tito eventually eliminate him. Tito hangs around for a little while. Bad News hangs around for a little while. Marty hangs around for a little while. And Savage hangs around. So this set of five guys actually hangs out for a little bit and stays in the match for a little bit. So,
all right. So the next entrant at number 16 is one half of the Brainbusters, Arn Anderson. And his teammate actually follows directly behind him, Tully Blanchard. So they start working as a team here throughout the middle portion of this match. Number 18 is, of course, Macho Man's tag team partner, and that's Hulk Hogan. Right. So in these four spots, 15 through 18, you kind of get that tag team run for these four guys. Number 19 is the other debut of the Bushwhackers, and that's Luke, Butch's cousin. And number 20, J-Fave extraordinaire Coco Beware with another pay-per-view appearance. So Hogan, once he enters, goes on quite the run. It really starts tossing guys. We'll get into the totals later. He gets on a run. He actually ends up tossing both Brainbusters. He tosses Luke and Coco as well. So he gets hot and really kind of sets the record right off the bat for this for the Rumble.
Right. And at number 21, we have one half of a big-time heel team right now, and that is, of course, the Warlord, one half of the Powers of Pain. At number 22 is another guy who's been involved currently in some pretty high-profile upper mid-card main event action, and that is the Big Boss Man. He's fresh from his co-beatdown of the Mega Powers at Survivor Series with his tag team partner, Akeem. Speaking of Akeem, he's in right next. And then remember there was a little bit of chicanery going on with these picks, if you remember. We'll get to the chicanery when we get to the end of the list. But don't you find it odd, Mr. Rosero, that the Big Boss Man and Akeem Twin Towers somehow went back-to-back? Very, very interesting. Why is that?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, the Brainbusters came back-to-back, so maybe it's not too fishy, but it does definitely seem like there's something there. And
yes.
It was kind of forewarned to us earlier in the show.
Yes.
But yeah, like you said, we'll get to that in a moment.
Yes. At number 24 is the Beefer, Brutus the Barber Beefcake. And at number 25... is, as Vince did in his nice banger main accent, the Red Rooster comes in at number 25. And he is, I believe he is still a kind of a pseudo heel. I don't know if he's turned face yet or if he even has the mohawk yet.
No, not yet. He's he is a face, but I don't think he has that look yet until WrestleMania.
Right. So there we are at number 25. Some eliminations. Let me see if those have occurred. Well, the Warlord lasts all of this is the infamous elimination. Warlord lasted all of 2 seconds before Hogan pitched him out. Boss Man didn't last very long, but you know his involvement continues. More on that in a moment. Akeem lasts a while, actually. Beefcake lasts a while, and the Red Rooster lasts a while. Meanwhile, some of the other eliminations. Marty Jannetty is taken out soon by the Brainbusters, of course, because the two teams are feuding with each other, so that made sense. As you said, Hogan goes on this mega run, eliminates some guys as well. But go right ahead and give us the last five because this is where the real intrigue comes in.
All right, so number 26 is the Barbarian, the other half of the Powers of Pain, comes in, and then number 27, Big John Studd, who makes his first pay per view appearance since WrestleMania 1, or was he in 2? Was he in the Battle Royal in 2? I always forget.
Who, Big John Studd?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was eliminated by, remember, the handshake with Refrigerator Perry, and he gets pulled out.
Yep, so since WrestleMania 2, Big John Studd's first pay-per-view appearance, he had been on the sidelines. I believe he was fighting diabetes or some other various ailments. And
yes.
He actually made his return as a face in late 88, early 89. And Vince actually had ideas to push him as a face and back into a feud with Andre the Giant, as we'll see as the year progresses. So. Yep. We'll keep an eye on that. Number 28 was Hercules, of course, the now a face. Number 29, the returning Rick Martel, who's coming back now after that injury at the hands of Demolition over the summer. Mm-hmm. So now he's back in the mix. And number 30 is the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. And as Scott mentioned, there was some chicanery going on. Earlier in the night, we saw Ted DiBiase very angry about the number he chose. So he goes up and talks to Slick, who was very happy and dancing and juking and jiving, as he always does, over his picks. And DiBiase made him an offer. And as we see here and is later revealed, DiBiase traded his pick. I'm sure there's some cash involved. Mm. He took the number 30 slot from Akeem, and they Akeem's able to move up and get back to back with the Big Boss Man. So I didn't think that was a great trade on Slick's part. He must have gotten rewarded quite handsomely to take his man out of the number 30 slot. So, but a shrewd move by DiBiase, and it would actually pay off the next year as well. They keep that going. So there are your 30 competitors. As you said, Hogan goes on a run and takes out most of these guys, pretty much wipes out a majority of them. But of course, the major elimination comes when he tosses Macho Man out. Now, Savage is fighting on the ropes with the Brainbusters, I believe, correct?
And Hogan. Let's see.
I think he was.
Yes.
And then Hogan
yes.
tosses all three of them out.
Yep.
Of course, he would play it off like he didn't think Savage was going to fall out and that he was just. Just trying to toss the Brainbusters. That's the impression you get. But Savage was pissed off, hops back in the ring, starts jawing with Hogan. They argue, and then Savage finally calms down and leaves.
Yes, let me confirm with you, because it goes in order of elimination. So where's Savage?
Yeah, he's right before the Brainbusters. So I'm pretty sure the three of them went out together.
Yeah, let's see. Arn, Warlord gets eliminated. It actually goes in a weird order. Warlord gets eliminated 18th. And then Savage 19th. So I wonder if
Maybe I was wrong. I might have been looking at that backwards.
Know what I think happens? I think I thought it was Warlord because Savage is battling with the Brainbusters on the ropes, and
you're right.
Hogan's in the other side of the ring, and he just walks over and pitches. He hits Arn and Tully, and then Savage just kind of is a victim of. Well, I'll use the infamous phrase, a victim of circumstance, and just kind of falls out of the ring with them.
Well, it could have even been Savage and Bad News. I can't remember now. We'll have to. Get that clarified because I was looking at the list in the wrong order.
Yeah, Bad News was eliminated at 20, so it's something of that nature. Might have to. I'm sure we'll both get frustrated and have to put the tape in or something. But so Savage kind of gets eliminated by accident, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the first of back to back years. We'll tell you. We'll obviously tell you who he does it to the following year.
No, it was Bad News. Savage, it's in your comments. Savage and Bad News. Savage is about to be eliminated by Bad News. Hogan comes over and tosses Bad News out, and Savage was kind of hooked up with him, and he goes over with him as well.
Right, okay. So that happens.
The Brainbusters were pitched earlier by Hogan.
Okay. Hogan eliminates Bad News, and Savage's arms kind of like, limbs are tangled, and Savage falls out too. Savage gets back in the ring, pisses and moans. No one else is in the ring right now, I don't think.
Yeah, they had to be other guys, I think.
Yeah, they must have been fighting in the other corner because those two actually had a chance to go through their rigmarole without any interruption of contact. So Savage is pissed. And at the time, you're like, well, yeah, I kind of see it. They yak and yak, and then Savage, Elizabeth gets in the ring, and they calm mm-hmm. down, and Savage leaves the ring. As the match progresses, the same team that was beating up Hogan at the Survivor Series kind of does it to him here, too. And that's, of course, the Twin Towers, Boss Man and Akeem, are kind of roughing him up here as well. They end up getting eliminated by both of them. Akeem and Boss Man get eliminated by Hogan.
At Survivor Series, not here.
At Survivor Series. Here, Hogan eliminates them.
Mm-hmm.
Boss Man gets eliminated by...
They double team Hogan and throw him out. Hogan bitches and moans on the floor. Now, this is where I take umbrage to this because, Hogan was taking offense at Savage was getting in his grill about Hogan tossing him out. And then two guys that are Hogan's enemies, the Twin Towers, eliminate Hogan and he pitches a fit on the floor, saying it was unfair that he was double teamed. I don't know what he was even crying about.
I don't either.
So Hogan gets eliminated. That's kind of a shock right there. And then Beefcake comes in, and he's fighting with the Twin Towers, and Boss Man goes to hit the ropes, and Hogan, from the floor, reaches up and pulls the rope down, and Boss Man falls out and gets eliminated. So Hogan not only pisses and moans, tosses out his friend, and then cheats to eliminate Boss Man. So he is not looking good here at all.
No, it's the beginning of a very suspect 1989 for the Orange Kingdom.
Yeah, and they would fight all the way to the back, and that would kind of... begin like a side feud for Hogan while he had this other stuff going on. Him and Boss Man would have quite the little house show run and Saturday Night Main Event feud, as we'll see throughout the summer.
Yes. You could tell that Vince had a soft spot for our man Ray Traylor. Mm-hmm. You could tell that he always had him in good spots. He was a good worker. And this is a reward. You know, he may not have won much, but, you know, you're on TV, you're getting a good payday. He earned it. So it was nice to see Boss Man get there. The match continues, and eventually our winner, and just to double check who was eliminated last.
It was DiBiase.
It was indeed number 30, Ted DiBiase, is eliminated by Big John Studd. And Big John Studd is your winner. He is the second ever winner of the 19 of the Royal Rumble, as he is the first pay-per-view winner of the 1989.
And now, just to talk about this a little bit as well, the final three. Well, I mean, once the Hogan and Boss Man fight to the back, things kind of die down at that point. The last few guys are kind of tepid. Martel, the last four are Martel, Studd, Akeem, and DiBiase. So kind of a bland final four. I don't know why they didn't just leave Beefcake in there at least to add a little more face pops. But
yeah,
Martel goes out first, and then Akeem and DiBiase kind of team up on Studd. Studd takes out Akeem, hits DiBiase with like a butterfly suplex, which was kind of nice actually.
Yeah,
And then pitches DiBiase to shockingly win. I mean, I guess they wanted a face to win the first time, and then they had plans to push Studd, but I think DiBiase kind of needed the win here to regain some of the heat he had lost through 88. And they could have played off that he, you know, his money worked and he was able to buy this victory. My main qualm with this Rumble here is this last segment. I don't know why they didn't save the Hogan Bossman stuff for the very end to at least carry that heat into the main event. Because I feel it's into the end of the match, rather. Because I feel like after that happens, the crowd completely dies because they don't really give a shit about Studd or any of these other guys in there. So I don't know why they didn't have, you know, the final four be Studd, or the final five be Studd, DiBiase, the Towers, and Hogan. And then you do the same ending, basically. You know, Towers eliminate Hogan. Hogan takes out the Boss Man, and the Studd quickly wipes out Akeem and DiBiase to get the win. I think that would have made it a tighter Rumble and a more exciting Rumble.
Right, exactly. I don't know whether, talking about Studd, I don't know whether Vince knew Studd was struggling health-wise. Maybe Studd was hiding that so he could, you know, make a little bit of schadol. I don't know what the deal was to let Studd win. Maybe it's just kind of a reward for a good career, because winning the Rumble at the time meant nothing. So maybe it was just kind of a thank you thing. I don't know. But you're right. The positioning at the end just kind of flattened the show. The crowd, even you can even tell the crowd's kind of out of it by the end.
Yeah, because he basically retired in 86. And then he came back as late 88 on the Brother Love show. Bobby Heenan was all happy, comes back to welcome Studd, but Studd rejected him and officially turned face there, basically. And he would stick around until June. He'd have his final match, June 4th, 89. So he was later died from liver cancer and Hodgkin's disease. So I don't know if he had either of those ailments in 89 or if his body was just breaking down on him at that point. So,
and he actually, and it is the truth. I did look it up. He did actually own a chain of 7-Elevens. So he actually did kind of make some money after his wrestling career. So at least he had, you know, he didn't die penniless or anything. He actually had some businesses. He just got very sick. Very unfortunate. But good heel in the 80s. I mean, we might as well talk about it. Well, we'll get more into it. We won't eulogize his career yet because he does show up one more time.
Yeah.
Overall, the Rumble, you know, had its good points. But, yeah, the laying out of the kind of the spots the last, like, 20 minutes – kind of flatten the end of the show. You're right. I mean, how you not have your last four guys are three heels and a moderately tepid face.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I agree with you about even someone like Beefcake. That's actually a great suggestion. Just a guy, you know, crowd likes him. Doesn't have to be anything fancy schmancy, but just a guy that can kind of keep the crowd sizzled and then get eliminated by.
Yeah, I think the way to go still would have been to have that Boss Man Hogan stuff happen at the very, very end. Because then you can really push that Hogan was screwed out of a win even more, you know, because it happens at the very end. So,
right.
I just think you could add more heat to a pretty bland finish. Well, let's hit the records quick. Mr. Perfect had the longevity record here, 2758. So a very good push for him. The shortest time who would hold this record for quite a while, actually, and that's the Warlord at 3 seconds. Yep. And Hogan, as we said, had the most eliminations with 9.
Yep. He would actually hold the record for 21 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So.
No.
20 years.
No, not even. Until 1997.
The Warlord?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about Hogan.
No, the Warlord.
Yes, Warlord would hold it for 21 years.
For 20 years. Yep.
Yeah. 20 Hogan's years. Would last for the next 8 years.
8 years. And that would, of course, be, well, we won't tell you who breaks it, but
we'll get there.
We'll get there. And so yeah, so there's your stats there. Again, the end of the show kind of flattens out. Crowd's kind of flat. You do get some major storyline twists and turns, but the end of the show, the very end, is not the Rumble, but the post Rumble interview, because the Master, he should have gotten the golden spoon. He should have gotten the Golden Spoon Award for officially stirring the shit properly. Mm-hmm. And that is, of course, Jesse the Body Ventura, who smells a rat, as he says, after the Rumble match. Goes backstage, interviews your World Wrestling Federation champion, Randy Macho Man Savage, wondering, what happened there, Macho? Your tag team partner seemed to have just tossed you over the ring. Wouldn't help you out. What does Savage do? Savage takes the high road, says, I was a victim of circumstance. Mega powers are still going strong, and we're going to continue to plug away and push forward. Jesse doesn't buy it. And with that, the copyright goes up, and we're off the air. Overall, not a overly awful show. Got some high points. We talk about the great Rude Warrior interaction, the pretty good tag at the beginning. The Rumble's not awful. It's not great. Of course, the women's match is a piece of crap. I gave it a C-. I don't know if this is the kind of show that I could throw in when I'm in the mood. There's other Rumbles I'd throw in when I'm in the mood. This wouldn't be one of them. I'd put this one on maybe just to watch the Rude Warrior interaction. That's my take. I gave it a C-. I thought it was good. Okay. Kind of ends flat. Like you said, the booking during the Rumble match is kind of herky jerky and kind of ruins the flow at the end of the show. So that's my take on this show.
Yeah, I gave it a C- as well. You know, outside of the novelty of the Rumble and the excitement surrounding it, it is pretty good here, but the end totally falls flat. It has a lot of historical importance.
Right.
I will give it that. But outside of that, in a few storyline advancements, not much else going on. The Rude Warrior stuff actually, to me, it was the highlight of the undercard. Good stuff there. The rest of the undercard, kind of a mess. So, you know, I think it could have been better if they would have kind of planned the undercard a little bit stronger and planned the layout of the Rumble. But for the first ever Rumble on pay-per-view, it's a solid show, and it sets up WrestleMania nicely. So,
yeah, exactly. So there is your 1989 Royal Rumble recap, review, mm-hmm. from your humble correspondence. And again, I hope you enjoyed listening to it. And of course, for the written transcript, quote unquote, if you will, you can go to our message board, the place to be, bigelow34.proboards.com. And you know, if you want to listen to it again, you can follow along with the comments. We are going to close the door. The safe is now closed.
Now, I didn't know if you wanted to prop it open though for one more minute.
You know what? I didn't close it all the way. Okay. I did open up a bit. Well, the non pay-per-view stuff is in this other other
in the crate
this other
next
room.
To it.
The crate, yeah, it's in the crate next to it because that stuff's not pay-per-view. We want to pump up, like we did when we did Rumble 88. We want to pump up the build to WrestleMania because for those that know it, WrestleMania 5 is an incessantly long show. And when we do that podcast next week, it's going to be quite long. So we want to get your build out of the way before we get to the actual show. So as mentioned, the Mega Powers kind of a little something, little tension, but Savage, the champion, who, you know, if you look at it at face value, essentially got screwed by his partner Hulk Hogan. But you know, the Mega Powers seem to be together still when the show ends. However, finally, after weeks and weeks of, you know, seeming like they're on the same page, the proverbial mierda hits the fan.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we set the I'm sure you have it in front of you at our history of WWE.com. Why don't you set the stage for us of when it finally, as the tagline goes, when did the Mega Powers officially explode?
That, of course, happened on a very famous episode of The Main Event. Not Saturday Night's Main Event, no. This is The Main Event.
Oh, Friday Night Show.
Yep, as we saw last year, the special Friday Night episode aired on February 3rd, 1989 on NBC, scoring an 11.6 rating, which is pretty huge.
That's huge.
For broadcast television. Of course, the opener There were only two matches in that show. The main event was Ted DiBiase and Hercules blowing off their feud. But the opener saw the Mega Powers teaming up against the Twin Towers. And it was a pretty big match, and I can see why they probably popped that big of a rating.
Well, it's officially the blow-off of the feud. It's the finally the two teams actually meeting in the ring in an official tag team match. You hadn't seen that. So it definitely, yeah, this was definitely the big, it was a big match. I remember getting pumped up a lot. Big ad and TV Guide, I remember.
And now the poster game. Graham has says 7 p.m. start time. So I don't know if...
That might be central.
I was going to say, yeah, this might have been a central time poster. So
yeah, it was definitely 8 o'clock. I remember definitely being 8 o'clock. Yep.
Oh, well, the match goes 22 minutes, and the Mega Powers eventually win when Hogan pins Akeem with a leg drop. But earlier is when really everything went down. During the match, Akeem tosses Savage over the top rope. He goes flying into Elizabeth, who takes a wicked, wicked bump. You know, Savage really wipes her out, and she just goes splat to the mat. Savage is rolling on the ground. He's out of it. Hogan hops to the floor to check on Liz, starts crying and doing his whole routine, picks Liz up and carries her to the back, leaving Savage alone to get the shit kicked out of him in the ring by the Twin Towers once again. So Hogan brings Liz back, make sure she's all set in the back. Then he heads back to the ring, stands on the apron, waits for the tag. But before Savage can tag him in, he smacks him in the face instead. Now this is where the official explosion occurs. Savage had enough, fed up, goes storming off to the back, leaving Hogan by himself. Of course, Hogan gets the win. No surprise there. Backstage, Hogan, and Savage and Liz are all in the, doctor's trainer's room. Liz is on a stretcher being checked out. Hogan's pleading with her, crying basically, that Savage doesn't know what he's doing. And he's asking her to talk to him and get things straightened out. Savage wigs out, jumps Hogan, beats the shit out of him in the trainer's room as Elizabeth screams. It was just a tremendous, tremendously booked angle to really ignite the final build into WrestleMania and culminate this one-year story that's been going on. So that pretty much sets the stage for the tagline of WrestleMania 5 in which the Mega Powers explode.
Yes. And the visuals, this build, and particularly that night on the main event, was all about visuals. And again, great camera angles because... As mentioned, as you said, Hogan is carrying Elizabeth down the ramp. But in the background, Savage is looking for the tag, and he's standing there looking at him on the ramp like, where the fuck are you going? Mm-hmm. I got these two guys that are 800 pounds combined, and you're worried about her? I mean, where the hell are the EMTs? You ever notice every other example of this? Secure, you know, EMTs and doctors and stuff come out, except this moment where Hogan has to carry them out. What were they all on coffee break? I mean, it always made me laugh that this is the one moment that he had that nobody came out to help her, even though it was her and not a wrestler. But yeah, the visual, it's perfect. It's perfect camera angle. Hogan walking Elizabeth down the ramp, but in the background, Savage is holding his arms out like, where the hell are you going? You know?
And I mean, really, when you look at the booking from Survivor Series through here, and even actually a little bit at SummerSlam, I mean, Hogan was clearly booked as the heel here, right?
No doubt. I mean,
it's bizarre the way they did it.
No, he's a complete gold-digging, you know, leeching worm.
Yeah.
You go back to Survivor Series, Savage is a crumpled-up mess in the corner, and he's sitting there with Savage's woman in his shoulders and posing, and everything's so hunky-dory, and he's like a train wreck in the corner, and Hogan could give a shit, you know?
And then at the Rumble, Hogan tosses Savage, doesn't show any remorse, and then throws a bitch fit when the Twin Towers eliminate him, and then here, obviously, as we just talked about, the main event.
Yes, it is clearly the pimp slap heard around the world, and I remember my brother was going, again, another moment that I always catch these great, you know, me being the orange Kool-Aid drinker I was, just like you were in your beginnings, you know, we were all hypnotized at the time. My brother, you know, older and more heel oriented, saw it from a mile away, and he was marking out, throwing popcorn at me when Savage beat the crap out of him. And I really think that, and we'll talk more about this when we reopen the vault for the WrestleMania 5 review. I think Jesse really had a vested emotional interest in this storyline. I mean, he knew what the result was going to be, obviously. But you could really tell, and we'll get more into this. I really want to get into this when we talk about the main event when we get to 5. He just seems so emotionally vested in this feud.
Mm-hmm.
You could tell him and Savage were tight and how much Jesse absolutely loathed Hogan as a human being.
Yes.
And you knew he was Jesse was a big, big Savage fan. Him and Macho were tight, I think, in real life. And Jesse just absolutely despised Hogan with a passion. There'd be some guys as we move down along 89, as you very well know, that Jesse probably hated even more. But we'll get to that. But you could just tell, and again, we'll talk more about it when we get to the WrestleMania 5 review, how much he truly hated Hogan and how this storyline just proves it. And it proves in the pudding. And Gorilla just had no explanation. It just Gorilla just couldn't do it. I kind of felt bad for Gorilla because the bookers just made him look like a jackass. It's unfortunate. He tried so hard, but really it didn't work. But we'll get more into that when we get to WrestleMania. But anyway, here's your there's your setup. Savage pimp slaps him, says, you know, screw you. He goes, you know, you could have asked me for a shot. That would have been the easy thing to do, as Savage says. And then but Hogan again does a terrible job because he's talking, and if you look very closely, he's talking to Elizabeth and he's saying, Liz, talk some sense into him. But Hogan's head is half cocked, waiting for Savage to hit him. Like, it just looks, Hogan just looks awful in that whole skit, in that whole little scene, because he's like, he's got his head half looking at Savage, and just, it's terrible. But in any event, there is the official explosion of the Mega Powers. I believe, if you want to look that up, I know you have it in front of you, I believe that show was in Milwaukee.
Yes,
I believe
it was. Yep.
Yeah, it was in Milwaukee. And so there at the old Mecca.
The Bradley Center.
No, it was a Bradley Center. I'm sorry. You know how I know that? Because I was just watching a game on the YouTube playoff game. 1988 was the Bucks' last game at the Mecca. That arena was actually literally brand new, the Bradley Center. Brand new that year, 88, 89.
You know, actually, this is something we should probably correct maybe on Wikipedia. According to a poster on our forum a couple years ago, he actually said that the Rock and Robin Judy Martin match was 6/24, not 16. So I don't know if Wikipedia just has a typo there. Let me check Gramsite out, because I don't know if he timed it off the video release, the DVD release.
You know what? Tomorrow, and we can make this correction on our headlines podcast later this week. I will talk to Matt Rotella because he does, you know, hopefully he was awake when he was watching it.
Well, Graham has it at 6/24, so I take his word over anything.
I definitely take Graham's word for it.
Okay, so we have to go back and we take that back the way we bitch about that 60. I mean, it's still 6 minutes too long on that, but
yeah, mind you, watching it probably feels like 16 minutes, but
that makes a lot of sense. The 16, obviously, they wouldn't have given 16 minutes to that match, probably.
No, probably not. But regardless, okay. So they cut 4 minutes out of that.
Yeah.
You really had that much. It makes me even more angry. Then, I mean, you really had that. You had to save that much tape space. I don't know. Whatever. I'm not gonna lament it. But it just makes me laugh. So there you go. There is your 89 Royal Rumble. That vault is closed. I will put our build up folder back in the cabinet. And next week we will be back on our next Vintage Vault and talk about the Mega Powers explode. Mm-hmm. And that is WrestleMania 5. That's a good show. I enjoy talking about that show. I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to talk about that.
I agree. It'll be fun. And before we get to that, let's wrap up Royal Rumble 89 with some feedback.
Yes.
We have two sets of feedback, one from the Place to Be Facebook page and one from our buddy Graham Cawthon's Facebook page, History of WWE. So
good.
Starting with the Place to Be, Tard Weber just wants to let us know we're on fire and he's enjoying the podcast and he finds it crazy that the British Bulldogs were only 1-4-1. When it came to pay-per-view and their closed-circuit shows.
Well, Todd, the unfortunate thing was by the time the Bulldogs really got on a roll, Dynamite was just physically a mess, and just better teams came in. 1985-86, they were the hot face team, but there weren't a lot of tag teams in late 85, early 86. By the time they won the tag straps and got into 87, 87 is when the tag division really exploded, and unfortunately, there were just better face teams. I feel bad. Trust me, I'm with you. It is very strange, but by then the face tag teams kind of lapped them. You know, it's unfortunate, but Dynamite's health just started to fall apart by then.
Right.
By the time that the tag division really started to reach its zenith, Dynamite could barely move. So. Yeah, I agree with you, Todd. It is kind of shocking, but unfortunately, they fell at the wrong place at the wrong time.
All right, and moving on, Karen Pollan checks in as always.
The hot Scott.
The women's title match is a gigantic fail of epic proportions. The Rumble match was excellent. It's almost impossible to have a bad Rumble match, although some would argue Vince Russo would succeed in 1999. So we'll get there when we get there. Mm-hmm. Jeremy Nichols, first off, I love the 89 Rumble, except for the winner. And secondly, my weekends are on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, so it'll be great to have a vault to start my weekend with. I can't wait to be a guest on your guys' show sometimes. Keep up the great work. And Jeremy, we can't wait to have you as a guest.
Yes, Jeremy is he's at the front of the line. But you know what? We are going to have our big contest coming up, trivia mm-hmm. stuff. So we do have a long line of possible future guest winners.
Yes.
So Jeremy, you're definitely on our short list. So yes. Stay tuned. You will be on soon, hopefully.
All right, Jason Greenhouse, can't wait to listen to the review, guys. On a side note, I finally listened to your interview with Graham Cawthon from History of WWE, and I can relate to his story about meeting Vlad the Superfan. I met him for the first time at MSG, and actually I cut off the thing. Hang on one sec. let's see more. MSG House Show back in 1994. He's a really cool guy. I even got his autograph and took a picture with him. I saw the autograph, but the picture's nowhere to be found. I was 14 back then, but over the years I bumped into Vlad at several shows, both WWE and ECW, and every time I see him, he's got a huge smile on his face, like a little kid going to his first show. Keep up the great work. So thanks, Jason, for that, and thanks for that cool little story about Vladimir. If any of you other guys have any cool little tidbit stories like that about meeting anyone or any house show experiences, share them with us here, and we'll definitely talk about them on air. But that's cool. Vladimir, obviously one of the most recognizable fans and personalities from that period of WWF shows and eventually ECW shows as well. So it's cool to hear these stories about him.
Don't see him a lot now. He's not on. He's not out as much as he used to be. Trying to think. I know we talked about this in the last, maybe it was four or five podcasts ago. He missed a few Manias. I don't think he was. Was he at this past one down in Atlanta?
Because Graham said he ran.
That's right. Graham was there. That's right. Yeah. Graham ran into him. That's right. I don't know. Did he go to Phoenix last year? I thought he said he didn't make it to Phoenix. I'm trying to remember. I know Graham had said that he had been working, so he couldn't make a few Manias. So, but yeah, I agree with you. Vladimir always pretty much the same seat, same spot on camera.
Mm-hmm.
Guy was a machine. He really was a machine. I mean, he was at like every pay-per-view for Jesus, 12 years, 13 years. I mean,
yeah, it was a while. And you know, he was a mainstay on those early Manhattan Center Raws as well. Mm. So, final piece of feedback from the Place to Be Facebook page, and that's from Jordan Duncan. Babyface Big John Studd sure turned out to be nothing special, huh? So, that about sums up that rumble.
Yeah.
Moving on to the History of WWE comments, their Facebook page, Carl Wallace checks in. Axe and Smash starting off the rumble match because it was the first time tag partners faced each other that way. Super posed down with Ultimate Warrior, Rick Rude, Battle of the Crown. Bobby Heenan ringside, you didn't know who the brain was leaning towards, but knew it would be the winner. So many memories, plus a classic pay-per-view. Brian Finley, this match has nothing to do with this post, but the match that I will never, ever forget was at Madison Square Garden. It was Superfly Jimmy Snuka versus Magnificent One. Don Morocco and Snuka flew off the top of the steel cage onto Morocco. I was about 7 years old, and my aunt Georgie took me. May God rest her soul. I love you, Aunt Georgie. The match was awesome. Thank you for that story, Brian. And he actually came right back. Sorry then. One more match my aunt also took me to was Bob Backlund, managed by God rest his soul as well. Arnold Scotland fought the Iron Sheik. Backlund was not 100%. Sheik put him in the camel clutch, and Scotland threw in the title. Sheik became the champion. Awesome match. R.I.P. Uncle Arnie. So thanks for sharing those memories, Brian Finley. It's cool that you were at a couple of historic matches there, Morocco Snuka and Backlund Sheik.
I am very impressed, Brian. Very impressed that you were able to go to two very, I mean, As we said, way back in episode one, that's the match that made me a fan. Snuka Morocco in the cage, October 17th, 1983. It's the match that made me a fan. I think it's a match that made a lot of people fans, including some memorable people in the Garden that night. Most notably, of course, Mick Foley, Bubba Ray Dudley, Tommy Dreamer. I believe those are the three main ones. And then you were there 2 months later for the end of an era,
mm-hmm.
With Morocco, with Backlund and Arnie Scolan, the Golden Boy. That's pretty impressive. Actually, it's interesting. I don't know if you knew this, Justin, but one of our former coworkers, Scott, who worked in my department, Scott was actually at the house show January 23rd, 1984, when Hogan won the title from the Iron Sheik. I don't think I've ever met anybody who actually was at that show.
Interesting.
Pretty impressive. Yeah, actually pretty impressive, of all people. But thank you, Brian, for those comments, and you're very lucky. And
mm-hmm.
Was it Aunt Georgie? I want to make sure she said that right.
Yes, Aunt Georgie.
Aunt Georgie, God rest her soul too. She's very, very lucky. Very lucky woman to have such a great nephew.
Yes,
and to go to some awesome shows. Good for you.
All right, moving on. Next feedback's from Roger Lee Vest Jr. That sounds like a jobber right around this time period.
sounds like a guy Vern would hire to team with Jake Milliman. I'm only kidding. No, it's a funny name. Very unique name.
Like Carl said, Axe versus Smash. Andre the Giant not winning, though a lot of people thought he was a lock. Hulk Hogan getting eliminated, then double teamed by Bossman and Akeem. Big John Studd returning are a few things I remember about this event. Probably my top five Rumble matches of all time. So Big Rumble 89 fan there, Roger. And closing out the feedback this week is Don Markowitz. After the 92 Rumble, this is my second favorite of all time. I love the demolition stuff, the Mega Power breakup tees, and Ted DiBiase buying number 30. The best part about this Rumble is Hulk Hogan did not go over. So some love for this show, which is cool to see as well.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, so cool. Good to hear some new voices on the feedback. Yes. Hopefully that that continues as well. So we'll go ahead.
We do like your name, Roger. Please don't take offense. We're just kidding. It is a very cool name, we have to admit. Anybody yes, who is. Can use who has that second middle name is very slick. I have to give you credit.
And with the junior tagged on the end as well. So.
Exactly.
All right, so we'll go ahead and wrap things up now for this edition of the Vintage Vault, Royal Rumble 89 / the main event. And join us back, should be Wednesday night. We'll be back with some headlines and our pay-per-view picks for Over the Limit. We'll hit up the continuing playoff talk, of course, any other wrestling news, and I may have to finally check in on the free-falling Yankee situation as well, so we'll get into that, too. I'll go on a Scott-like rant.
Yeah, you might have to, because you're sitting here touting the fact your sexy NBA picks, and as I put on our page, when the playoffs are over, what are you going to hang your hat on? you're gonna have something else to hang your hat on. So
hey, just the fact that I have two teams, and you and Reesh have zero combined.
Well, I admit and I apologize, and we'll get more into this on the next podcast. I picked with my heart, and I shouldn't have. You picked with your – as an analyst. I picked as a fan. I wanted to see another Celtic-Laker final, and that clearly is not happening. I don't know what Reesh's excuse is, but
we'll give Reesh the benefit of the doubt with the newborn. We'll just say he wasn't thinking very
that's
clearly.
True. He wasn't thinking, yeah.
He was pretty awful with his march. May's not as good an analyst as we think. May's just a better historian. We'll have to take him to the table on that in our finals preview. So
exactly.
We'll go ahead and wrap things up again. Join us later this week. So far, as always, Scott Griscolo, I'm Justin Rosero. We're going to leave you with the rare theme song of the winner of this Royal Rumble, and we'll talk to you later this week. Thanks for listening.
Peace.